From Chicago, this is a Beyond the Beltway special edition featuring weekly updates on Chicago and Illinois politics, including the race for mayor, as well as alder track reports on the key city council races for aldermen. Now sitting in for Bruce Dumont is veteran journalist Dan Miller.
Greetings, greetings, and welcome to Beyond the Beltway. I am Dan Miller, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on this special TV edition of Beyond the Beltway, while we focus exclusively on state and local government elections. We're coming to you from the Beyond the Beltway base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street in Chicago, probably the most exciting museum you have yet to visit in Chicago. I hope you will. Tonight we have commentary brought to you by Dan Rutherford, former treasurer of the state of Illinois, Eric Herman, managing director of ASGK, the public affairs and communications firm founded by David Axelrod, Tony Arnold, statewide politics reporter for WBEZ Public Radio at 91.5 FM, and as usual, Mike Fouché of AlderTrack, the online news source about the people, politics, personalities in the February 24th mayoral election. Well, the Chicago mayoral election is indeed just a couple days away as we tape this program, and we'll look at the quality of that campaign as we get into the program. But what's really on political junkies' mind is Governor Rauner's budget. Governor Rauner unveiled a budget for Illinois' 2016 fiscal year, which begins July 1st. He proposed to reduce state spending by 18% to a mere $31 billion. While many of the reductions come in high-profile departments such as higher education, community support program, and aid to local governments, a few departments received increases, including the Department of Corrections. And to the surprise of some people, including me, he didn't propose any new taxes or borrowing. Dan Rutherford, you spent 22 years in government, in state government, in addition to your private sector work.
Sure.
How surprised were you that Governor Rauner did not propose not only no spending increase, tax increase, but no borrowing?
I think at this juncture, I'm not surprised. Now, obviously, the stage has been set in his earlier comments, particularly in regards to taxes on certain types of services. So I think that the balloon has been floated out there. But it's probably a lot to do with, as some of my colleagues around the table may concur with, is a lot of positioning. Lay out there the draconian cuts right now, looking at the $2.2 billion pension resolution that he anticipates having within the year, and then doing no borrowing. I'm not sure that it truly, bottom line, is realistic. And I think that it's been positioned now that fees and taxes are going to be a part of the discussion at some point during this session.
So strategically, he leaves the ball pretty much in the Democrats' court. If you want to fund these programs, then come up with an idea, which would be raise taxes.
And definitely the state budget is initiated by the governor, and then the board of directors, the General Assembly, needs to deal with it and come back with their proposals. And because we have a supermajority Democratic control in both chambers, we've got a Republican governor, I think that they're going to have a very, very much of a fingerprint and implement some procedures that he's not ready to have happen right now.
Eric Herman, is Governor Rauner really going to balance his budget on the backs of the poor and academics in higher education?
I don't think so. My read on this budget speech was that it was not serious.
Not serious? Right. Not realistic or not serious?
Well, I mean, ultimately not serious. I don't think it was intended... or at least I certainly don't think it's a serious budget. I don't think it's realistic. I think that it was a piece of political theater more than anything else. And that's fine. I mean, politics are politics.
So you would like to have seen him propose some taxes, some borrowing, dig a little deeper into the hole we're already in?
Well, I don't really think it matters what I would like to see or not, but what certainly doesn't matter to him.
It's okay. It doesn't matter to me.
Right.
Well, it matters to our viewers.
But I think that there's a certain intellectual dishonesty to that whole spiel. So it's a little hard to take it seriously. It's posturing, and it's
the intellectual dishonesty. Is that like a exclusive to the situation now, or is that?
Oh no. There's no shortage of intellectual dishonesty in Springfield. It's by no means. I didn't mean to imply that the new governor by any means had a monopoly on that particular asset. I think that just the idea of not putting any revenue in the picture, or these massive cuts to higher education. I mean, that's the kind of thing. that's the kind of thing that loses you middle-class votes.
Tony Arnold, down in Springfield, where you spend an awful lot of time, members of the General Assembly and were pretty predictable. I think Eric reflects part of that, that the Democrats, liberals see it as heartless and short-sighted, whereas the Republicans see it as fair and realistic, finally. Is there any more nuanced approach to what the governor said than those two extremes that you picked
up? I think what hasn't been said is that the governor sees this as making Springfield efficient. That's kind of how he's – that's mm-hmm. the framing of this proposal that he put out there. I think he knows very well that this is not going to get the majority of votes in the House or Senate. This is, from his point of view, as Dan said, that this is the beginning of negotiations from his point of view, and he's taken the far side of no taxes, no new taxes, no higher taxes even, and just pure cuts. It's almost in the same way this was done last year by the Democrats. They said if the income tax is dropped, they brought out department heads of several state agencies saying, well, child welfare is going to be cut and we're going to have to do this. And Department of Aging is going to be cut and we're going to have to cut this. And it was seen as a political move. So here we have Governor Rauner taking the same kind of strategy, but for a different purpose, really, than how Democrats used it.
Mike Fouché, from a strategic standpoint, doesn't it make sense? Okay, you think it's unrealistic and unfair and so on, but didn't he really put the onus now on the Democrats to propose higher taxes?
Sure, but you know, I mean, as Eric said, I think that there's a lot of intellectual dishonesty. The whole point is that nobody really believes that what any governor is going to propose is going to become a budget, that it's going to become a huge fight and everybody's going to argue about what it is that's going to come out in the end. And there'll be all kinds of jujitsu moves in order to make sure that one person wears the jacket on one thing versus another. And what if I was Governor Rauner, I don't want to imagine that. But I think that Governor Rauner is an excellent negotiator. That's how he got to be successful with private equity. You have to be able to know how to negotiate. But he's also going up against a guy, Mike Madigan, who holds a lot of cards. And knows the playing field in Springfield better than he does. And so I think he probably needs to set up as difficult a negotiation situation for Mike Madigan as possible.
Dan, you've been down in Springfield on all sides of that issue. What role is Madigan going to play in this?
Significant. I mean, I answer the obvious gentleman.
Oh, we got an limb there, Dan.
I see no opposition to my proposal. I mean, the speaker will play significant, and I, you know, I've worked with the speaker over a number of years. I'm a Republican; he's a Democrat. I've been in the House, I'm in the Senate, I'm a state treasurer, and a private sector business guy. But the one thing that I did find quite candid, but the speaker's comments after the governor's address, was the fact that he made it up front clear. He says, "I don't believe that this is realistic." That he had proposed the fact that he believes that revenue needs to be a part of the discussions, and he's not shying away from it. It was right up front.
Go ahead.
No, go, Tom.
I would just say that there are two elements to what Madigan's saying that I think are interesting. One is that he's still continuing to call for a higher tax on millionaires around the state of Illinois.
And hold that second thought, Tony Arnold, because after these messages, we'll come back and we'll ask you, what is that second element that we're going to look for Mike Madigan for? You're listening to and watching Beyond the Beltway. I'm Dan Miller. We'll be back right after these messages.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger. And I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
The Beltway in our second segment. I'm Dan Miller sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Before the break, we were listening to Tony Arnold of WBEZ. He has an idea about what Mike Madigan is going to do as he approaches, in a strategic sense, the Rauner budget, which he already has said he doesn't care for. Tony, what was – first was the millionaire's tax. He's already raised that as a revenue enhancer. What was the second thing?
The second thing is more of a political point of view or the political perspective of this – what the consequences of this budget, which is that Speaker Madigan sometimes puts up bills or puts out topics in come election time that, in which a candidate that's going against usually a Republican who's against one of his own members of his house during election time, he'll use one of these bills, he'll put up a test bill, let's say, to cast a vote for representatives to cast a vote, and then he can use that against them come election time. The last time I can think of this being an issue was the issue of gun control in schools, and he had mailers that were sent around about included gun casings in schools. So what he could do with this is say, you know, if you are for the Rauner budget, you're for all these cuts to social services, to all these kind of sensitive political issues.
Eric Herman, you're a political consultant. That seems to make sense, doesn't it? A good response?
Yeah, and I think that, I think Speaker Madigan and President Cullerton are both skillful negotiators and chess players. So I think it's going to be a very interesting year.
So are we going to see these dire predictions of, as Tony indicated, if you are in favor of this budget, you are in favor of putting people in a wheelchair and pushing them over the cliff. Is it going to be that kind of preposterous positioning, or is it going to be more substantive?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure, Dan, that I entirely agree with your characterization. I'm sure we'll hear some of that, but I don't think that all of it is entirely preposterous. I mean, even though I said a minute ago that I thought that Rauner's budget address was political posturing, mm-hmm. I mean, at least as a starting point, we have to take him at his word, and let's look at the real-world implications of some of the things that he's proposing. And, for example, let's look at the impact on higher ed. There are a lot of people here who send their kids to state universities. Mm-hmm. How is that going to affect them? They tend to be, I think, for the most part, middle-class people. And then another one, what's going to be the effect on you know, people who are disabled? Or this is my favorite, the LIHEAP program, which covers...
Low-Income Energy Assistance Program.
Exactly. Rauner wants to take that money and sweep it into the general fund. And so I guess, we're just going to let poor people freeze? I mean, so you could say that I'm just engaging in histrionics. But on the other hand, if you follow what he's put out there to its conclusion, that's actually real.
Mike Pouchet, you've run campaigns. Is that going to work again this time?
I would never prognosticate whether or not it would work because I have no idea. I'm truly, honestly, I have no idea. But I think that what Eric says is very true. I think that there are a lot of very real serious things that are part of this and that Rauner, to some extent, has staked out what he thinks the government is supposed to be about, which is, if you listen to his speech, he says he feels that he's responsible or government, people in government, moral responsibility to create an efficient government. Well, you know, great, but exactly where did you hear taking care of the people who are most needy? And that wasn't really part of that discussion. And one of the things that concerns me is that there's a lot of talk about shared responsibility, but you know, the shared responsibility that we're talking about here is cuts.
Yeah, and I think the political dynamic that is going to be very fascinating to watch as this unfolds will be the Republican caucuses in both chambers. I mean, they've got now a Republican governor, and both caucuses are in the super minority. And my sense, to Tony's point earlier, I would think, and having watched the speaker in the past, put bills up and necessitate votes from the minority party to support their governor or not support their governor.
What would those look like, Dan?
I think kind of going to some of the stuff that we saw Eric talking about, you know, say at the LIHEAP program, you can cut the low-income, you know, energy assistance program outside of the whole macro budget and have a single standing bill. Do you support eliminating LIHEAP?
Right.
Up or down?
Right.
Okay, now you've got a roll call. And you're also then somewhat boxing the Republican Party minority with their governor to say, are you going to support him
right.
or not on that very specific thing that he has in his budget?
Are you going to support autism funding?
You can list every one of those, right. Pull them out line item by line item. You don't put them in a macro package. You put them in a micro bill. And just add one more thing, and my colleagues here chime in as they will. But then you also have at the very end of the calendar year, last year, before the financial disclosure campaign contribution limits went into effect, that Bruce Rauner, not Governor Rauner, Bruce Rauner and a couple of his friends added into his campaign account to create $20 million sitting in that political treasury after the first of the year that he has made very clear he intends to use for political purposes come the next election
that
cycle.
That purpose... But, yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I'm sorry, Dan. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. How seriously do you think the Republicans in the General Assembly are taking that? I mean, are they... How much clout or suction is he going to have, do you think, with his members?
And having served in both chambers, having had to go out and raise money, having run for a statewide office, this is something that has never been seen in Illinois politics.
What?
The size and magnitude of a campaign treasury by an individual who has made it abundantly clear that he intends to be active in the political process.
Now, when,
and
when
I don't fault that.
Let me add one more thing here,
going back to Eric. The second thing that's impactful on this is you have a Republican governor with a Republican caucus, and a Republican governor has a great deal of ability to be able to encourage or not encourage members of that caucus by everything from personal appearances to going to political fundraisers to appointments to meeting people that want to come to the Capitol and meet the governor. I mean, those emoluments of the office add to the prestige and power.
But I just want to make clear with this Rauner Fund has two purposes. One, he can give money to candidates who support his legislative agenda. That was your point about raising money. Or he can put money against those same candidates in a primary to get them to behave.
Right. So one of the things that I'm very curious about, though, is that there was also a thing that Rich Miller and Capital Facts reported where Rauner went to people and said to members of the House and the Republican members of the House and Senate, if you don't support me, I'm going to blank you or something like that. Something bad will happen to you. So it's clear that he's going around and saying, here's the stick. But what's the carrot? I mean, in my mind, I thought that $20 million was supposed to be more threatening to Mike Madigan than to members of the House Republican caucus or the Senate Republican caucus. Right?
What's the difference?
Well,
Mike, same thing, right?
Well, no, there's one, which is you go after members of the caucus who break the ranks.
Right.
Which, you're threatening the members in order to stay in the ranks. And the other is I'm going to go after Mike Madigan and try and beat him or get more people that are Republican in the caucus, which would be a lot more appealing to them.
Tony Arnold, do you see in the General Assembly that this fund that Rauner has is going to be playing an important part in how people vote? This fund.
I think, to your point, is that it might play a bigger role with Republicans than it would with Democrats. Speaker Madigan has never been known to have trouble raising money or spending it, and he even said earlier this week after the budget address, you don't need $20 million to get your point across effectively. So I don't think he feels that threatened by this money of Rauner's.
Eric, you had some doubt. Go ahead.
Well, there was an anecdote, I think I read it in Rich Miller or something like that, about what you were talking about, where he took a bunch of Republican legislators, maybe
Rauner.
It was at Saputo's or something, and said, the first thing he says, first of all, I don't want to read about this in Capital Facts.
Right,
of course,
yeah.
It ended
right.
Up
Oops. It's so awesome.
So, which indicates to me that maybe they aren't taking him as seriously as he would like. But let me say this, though, in Rauner's defense. It may be that his gambit with his budget address ends up being politically very clever. I just think it's too early to tell. There is a certain panache to it, and it may be that he is setting a trap for the Democrats, and they come in and say, "Oh, we love taxes," and then he gets to go on the national stage, which I have no doubt is his ambition, and talk about how he's a tax cutting, belt tightening bazillionaire, and a
Republican governor in a blue state,
who can reach across the aisle,
right,
and all that jazz.
Right, right.
So time may prove that he is a very skillful politician. We don't know.
Dan Rutherford, is there? There are some taxes that have been talked about that are likely to come up that I expected to see in the Rauner proposal. For instance, increasing the personal and corporate income tax is one. Extending the sales tax to services, tax retirement income above $50,000, excluding Social Security, new tax on food and non-prescription medicines. Are these things likely to come up in discussions?
I think yes, and in particular, and I don't want to try to represent particularly President Cullerton's position, but John has been pretty open in the past with regards to the expansion of taxes potentially on certain types of services. I mean, that's not been any secret about it. So I do think so. And I, you know, the way you negotiate a budget, literally, I would think, is to close the door and say everything's on the table. You know, with all respect, I'm not sure I particularly care to want to go back to the same tax structure we had for corporations and individuals, but put it on the table. And then you keep going down all of those and negotiate a comprehensive as opposed to trying to go through each one of these singularly.
Tony, I think that would be awesome. That would be amazing. But I think there are too many different components of the budget that require a trust between the two parties. I mean, if you're going to make a change in the tax structure, that means you're going to have to pass a series of things and maybe even some constitutional amendments, I think.
It depends on which taxes.
And so if you're going to be making some of those changes, that requires a whole series of things that you're agreeing, you're going to hold hands together, and it's going to take a number of months in order to make it work. And I don't know that there's that kind of trust.
I don't disagree with you on that part. I don't know that there is either. But there are – the type of taxes you're talking about would require constitutional amendments would be, as Tony had said, had been talked about earlier, if there would be a separate type of separation of tax for a certain income level.
Right.
Or if there was a variance between the spread of personal and income.
Dan,
that would require
constitutional amendments. Speaking of the Constitution, we've got a constitutional issue on the pension bill, which could blow a hole in the whole budget completely. When we come back, Tony Arnold will tell us just what is pending on the constitutional amendment. We'll be back in just for a minute.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
And welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Dan Miller sitting in for Bruce Dumont on the last week. Bruce will be back next week. You are hearing commentary tonight by Dan Rutherford. Dan, what are you
up to? Good to be with you. Well, I've had the opportunity to serve in both the State House, the State Senate, State Treasurer, ran for governor. 25 years in the private sector, and now I'm just kind of enjoying life and being able to go on shows like yours and play exactly what I think is going on, good and bad, in Springfield. I'm like a dog without a collar right now.
Watch that, man. Eric Herman, what are you up to?
I am a managing director at ASGK Public Strategies here in Chicago. We're a public affairs firm, and we work with corporate clients and nonprofits on public issues of great import.
Founded by a pretty high-profile individual?
That's right, a gentleman named David Axelrod.
And Tony Arnold.
I cover Illinois politics for WBEZ.
Which is public radio. It's not just any WBEZ. It's you're in the top 10
now. That's right.
Yeah,
and actually, yeah, numbers came out. And last month, we made the top 10 in the Chicago market for mornings.
Congratulations.
For drive time. Big deal. Yeah. Big deal. 91.5 FM. Nice going. And Mike Fouché on Alder Track.
So Alder Track, we cover the soup to nuts, every last aspect of the aldermanic races in Chicago. We're getting ready for the big election on the 24th, and then also runoffs, too. We expect quite a few runoffs this
year. How many of those do you expect will have shown up?
I'm putting my money down on at least 18, maybe as many as 22.
Wow, that's a lot. That'll be fun for election judges who have to show up. But
wow.
We're taping this program several days before the February 24th election. So you'll know by the time you see this what's going on. Speaking of what's going on, Tony Arnold, right now before the Supreme Court in Springfield is a major constitutional question that deals with the unfunded pension liability and how to fix it in the state of Illinois. Can you give us an update on that, please?
In short, the legislature in 2013, at the end of that year, passed a bill and was signed by the governor that in short, reduce some benefits for state employees and their retirements. That's been challenged by the unions. It's been working its way through the courts, and everyone's been kind of waiting for this because a lot hinges on the constitutionality of this bill. The Supreme Court agreed to hear this case in the beginning of March.
March 11th.
And yeah. Then we'll see where all this kind of – this is – I mean, we're talking $100 billion and of the state and of the state's money at stake here. So it's a major bill. Unions oppose this big time because they say you don't have the rights to cut our retirement benefits, and legislators say we don't have any other way to balance our budget without doing something like this.
So, Eric Herman, if the Supreme Court rules that that bill is unconstitutional, there's, in addition to all the other holes in the budget for the state of Illinois for fiscal 15 and 16, there's an even bigger hole. How does that compare, since you brought up earlier about do you want to take poor people and let them freeze in the dark if you drop the LIHEAP program and so on? How do you balance that? What's the way out?
Well, first and foremost, the way out has to be constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that...
You're a lawyer, too, aren't you?
Yes, I play one on TV,
yes.
As they say.
Go ahead.
And I think that was, you know, President Cullerton's point, you know, all along, that we need to have a constitutional solution. You know, time will tell whether or not, you know, what the Supreme Court does with this particular bill. I think a lot of well-informed people think that they will throw it out. And then it's back to the drawing board. I mean, literally back to square one.
Well, and I think the powerful thing to think about in this as a follow-up to that isn't just this bill, this Supreme Court, but the governor's budget address had factored into it to be a balanced budget, albeit cut back considerably. I believe it was about $2.2 billion worth of savings under a proposal he has that would change the type of pension systems for tiers of state employees. And I don't think there's any question that that will have to be determined as whether it's constitutional or not. And I think that's going to be an even bigger issue as we get to this whole negotiation stage. $2.2 billion is a massive part of this budget put together.
So massive that it can't be done in just 1 year. I think everybody recognizes that. Just as I think you're right, Eric, that the sentiment, the consensus of pundits and whatever is that that bill is going to go down. Do you think that the Supreme Court is going to try to knock it down on a granular level and say, well, this part is no good, this part might survive, this will they give some direction at the Supreme Court, or will it all go down in flames? What's your reading?
I mean, I think that the truth is I don't know.
Yeah,
but
my guess
is that it will be a constitutional argument. It will say that this is pretty plainly barred by the language of the Illinois Constitution. I mean, the irony here is that not too long ago, there was an initiative on the ballot about whether or not we should have another constitutional convention, mm-hmm. which pretty much, as I recall, I could be wrong, but as I recall, every major business group opposed.
Right.
And I think
all
a lot
the labor unions.
And I think
opposed.
A lot of I was going to get there.
Yeah.
A lot of labor unions opposed.
Right.
And most if not all the editorial boards opposed.
Right.
And. But if we had rewritten the state constitution and changed the language with respect to pensions, we wouldn't
you're
be.
You're
in this
assuming
pickle.
That would be the only thing.
Well,
that we
but
done.
I
or that it would have gotten to that same conclusion.
I think the last time we had a constitutional convention,
1970,
was the rise of Pat Quinn, who became a major problem for a lot of people that were in the business of trying to run the state.
Well, wasn't that also the rise of? Mike Madigan and Rich Daley too. That convention.
I don't think Rich Daley really required that in order to rise. And
well,
I
it depends. Mean, are you talking about? Are you talking about the cutback amendment that Quinn put into place as a constitutional
yes.
amendment?
This
yes.
eliminated
yeah.
the
as opposed to the 1970 Constitution.
That's true. Yes.
No, you're right. That
right.
And that's interesting because the provision of the Illinois Constitution that can be changed without going through either a constitutional convention. And can be done by a public initiative is the articles dealing with the General Assembly's reorganization. And that's what Pat Quinn
did. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
So I think that there was a fear that if there was a constitutional convention, it would be opening up Pandora's box mm-hmm. and everything would be
exactly.
at stake. And who knows what could happen to the state of Illinois and who knows who would be running the state of Illinois after that. I mean, I agree, actually. I think it might have been a good thing, but managing that
well,
process.
Mike, let me ask you this.
Tough.
Do you believe, thinking back of the men and women who were there in 1970 who wrote it?
Yeah, and
look
boy,
at the quality
I was really
of men
alive
and women,
then.
Well,
Well, I was. I was watching Sesame Street.
Good
but
for
I was
you. Okay.
I'm sorry I brought that up. I will just tell you, having been there and covering at that time a lot of business and politics.
Wow, man, you look good.
In 1970, he's a marathon runner. The people today don't compare at all with those people. Tony Arnold, nobody's talking about that except around this table down in Springfield, are they? Resurrecting the Constitutional Convention idea to fix this?
That wouldn't be up for another, 15 years? No one's talking about that.
They'd have to do a ballot initiative or something
Yeah.
All right. There is one department or a couple departments that have seen increases. One of them is the Department of Corrections. Rauner has seen a 7% increase to nearly $2 billion in that department, if I read the budget correctly. Tony, what's going on in corrections that they get extra money and other and Eric Herman's people don't?
I think this is all related, but the case that the governor's making is that the conditions in the prisons are awful. He's saying that they're run down, that they need a lot of just basic walls, and that there's overcrowding.
And if the
corrections workers had more overtime or had more employees, that there would be safer conditions for inmates. I know that the treasurer, has done a lot with prisons in the past because he's represented parts that have prisons.
Right. I think the other thing, and this is kind of the business approach, which I do like, is the fact that in corrections there's so much recidivism. That you bring them in, you lock them up, you hold them there, then you let them go. Mm-hmm. And you don't teach them to read. The inmates, the average education level at Pontiac Correctional Center is sixth grade.
Is that right?
So if you are educated at the sixth grade level felon walking out the doors, and, you're not going to have an opportunity. So those kind of thinking through investments for returns, I like the business approach to that. I think there is a considerable need in corrections. I commend the governor for doing that. Now, then you go on to other parts of the budget.
But just to stay on corrections, sure. For one example, this is an issue that Tony Preckwinkle, County Board President, also rides very highly, to reform mandatory sentencing, to decriminalize some nonviolent crimes.
I mean, particularly when Jim Thompson was governor, that's when you had a lot of these mandatory sentencing. I mean, everything from Class X, and this goes back to Tony's comment earlier with regards to roll calls. If you're a legislator out there and you've got this bad guy does bad stuff, and you say, by golly, we're going to make X number of years as the penalty, if you're not supportive of those types of things, then you can be seen as being soft on crime. That's the politics to that issue.
Eric, you're in favor of seeing decriminalization of some crimes, nonviolent?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's too much incarceration of things like, possession and marijuana and things like that. I mean, I think that's well documented.
I think there's a major problem that the fact that Illinois, after the various mandated federal programs, the second largest spending is on prisons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to a certain extent, we've come to rely on that for a lot of solutions. And
like mental health solutions, where to put mental health.
Right, exactly. And so, we need to start figuring that out much more as a systemic problem. But that's going to take money to fix before you're going to be able to start saving.
Right. And this is what Democrats are saying is the problem with Bruce Rauner's budget, is that if you are sending more money to corrections, but you're cutting money to
mental health.
Substance abuse programs, rehab programs, anything else that affects the prison population, you're just going to be end up spending more on corrections down the road.
We're all agreeing, yes, there are huge numbers of problems, but there's a huge hole. There just isn't enough money to go around. Now, Mike?
I think that to a certain extent we had a boom time for a long period of time when we really enjoyed it, and I think we spent beyond our means, and now we got to figure out how we're going to pay. That's really how I see it.
And something, Dan, I noted this earlier. You said about borrowing, digging ourselves deeper in the hole. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with that, but there is a certain part of structured, planned, calculated borrowing. Just like if you're going to have a mortgage on your home, you just don't go out and buy a home you can't afford.
Let's look at that when we come back after these messages from our sponsors. We'll be back at Beyond the Beltway. Stay with us.
Sponsors, you want to pay for the bills, so I'm not getting
one. Your business requires on-time payroll processing, affordable health benefits, workers' comp, and force optimization is a suite of HR services that takes care of all of this and more.
helping your company run better, grow faster, and make more money.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
And welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. I'm Dan Miller, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Before the break, Dan Rutherford, former treasurer of the state of Illinois, was bringing up the issue of a reasonable restructuring of debt.
Yeah, I think you know, you were talking about, you know, I'm not supportive, nor do I encourage that we do borrowing to dig ourselves deeper in the hole. And two, I want to point out, I too do not support sweeping funds out of specialty accounts and just to take them out of there. So your barber, Dan, your barber pays a fee to your barber pays a fee for his barber's license, and that goes into a specialty fund. There's proposals out there to take that money out of there. What you can do, because of various times of the season, cash flow, you could borrow from those funds, as has been done in the past, with the commitment of the General Assembly to pay it back with interest, and then as the cash flow comes back in the other side, put it back in there. It's those types of, I think, smart business approaches, understanding that you can go out and look and do those.
Tony, is there any opportunity for these ideas that Dan Rutherford just brought up, or the other ideas that clearly this can't be done on a piecemeal basis? It's got to all fit together simultaneously, the different pieces, to get a picture. Is it possible?
We'll see. I don't know. With this budget,
Are you optimistic at all?
I'm planning for a not complete budget to be passed, and that's going to be extended. Usually the legislature votes on these things at the end of May because they have to, and I don't expect this. I'm planning for a long summer, a long, drawn-out fight, probably that will involve not just politicians but also the labor unions bringing in their own issues into the budget address also. It's going to be very ugly.
The oral arguments before the Supreme Court on the constitutional question, which we just discussed, are scheduled for March 11th. If they acted right away, that would leave 2 months at most for the General Assembly to adapt to what we think is going to be a ruling of unconstitutionality to create a budget. Eric, possible? 2 months?
I'll say this. I think it's going to be – I think Governor Rauner is going to be really good for the news business.
but not for vacations for news people.
But I think that – and the news business can use all the good news that it can get these days. But no, seriously, I mean, I think that it's going to be a very interesting session. I think that Governor Rauner is going to be much more of a force to be reckoned with than Governor Quinn was. I think that I don't think I'm going out on a limb by saying that I don't think the two legislative leaders took Quinn particularly seriously. And I think that they're going to have to take Rauner seriously. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting session.
Well, an interesting session coming up, too, the mayoral election, which was held February 24th in Chicago. Mike Fouché, you have covered that election through the alderman and also at the mayoral level. What do you make of that? Was this a good campaign by the aldermen? Let's look at that first. They didn't even touch the issue of the fiscal catastrophe that's facing the state.
Well, the races that are significant really are much more about individuals more than anything else. I mean, aldermanic races are very personal. They're about referendums of what people think about them. You know, the stuff about in the 17th Ward, the mudslinging that's going on between the two candidates there, you know, that's very personal. It's about individuals.
Which ward is that?
The 17th ward is part of Englewood, and it's David Moore and Glenda Franklin. And there's I won't go into the details, but there's a slime piece about David Moore that's been pushed around the ward. And, you know, that's really all about trying to be a referendum on David Moore. It's an open seat race, and these are two very solid candidates who have their own support groups. In the 7th Ward, much more about a personal vendetta, or not really a vendetta, but personal feelings between the sitting alderman, and Keanna Barrett, who had worked for the previous alderman. So, you know, all of it is personal. And
the city's financial problems just don't arise to the level of voter interest or candidate interest.
It's too hard for people to really parse and for voters to parse. And there really aren't clear this side or that side positions in Chicago. You know, it's not as if there's a group of people in Chicago, there's a coalition of people that are for raising taxes, and there's a coalition of Chicago who are for cutting stuff. You know, it's much more about what is the mayor going to propose and jam through city council.
Dan Rutherford, from your perspective in Pontiac, but also you got more votes than Governor Quinn did in your election.
I ran for city treasurer.
Sure. What do you make of the election in Chicago? The campaigns, rather.
Well, you know, I see some of it, but I think it's interesting the way that Mike puts it. I concur that this does seem to be like a personality contest. I want to put words in your mouth, Mike, but a personality contest for the aldermen and for them to be able to talk about specifics on what they would do from a macro standpoint from the city council is somewhat overshadowed by the mayor's race.
Meaning that the mayor ought to be addressing the fiscal issues, but they're also it's also absent from his campaign.
Well, but you know,
he's got three guys who could have brought it up as well.
He's got lots of money. He can put out the message he wants.
$1.2 million in the last week, you know, just on TV, and there's probably at least that much going in the mail, if not more.
Eric Herman, what do you think of the mayor's and aldermanic races, the campaigns? Does this reflect well on Chicago? Does this show savvy politicians dealing with statecraft?
Boy, statecraft, there's a word you don't often
hear. Yeah, right? Not in
same
Chicago.
Same sentence with Chicago politics. I think that, you know, I think Rahm has run a very smart race, and I think that he will... I think he'll avoid a runoff. I think that the opponents he drew have not run especially impressive
campaigns.
Do you
think that's why he agreed to all the debates he did? Not because he was broad-minded. He wanted to show how shallow the competition
was. Yeah, and I think it was very clever. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that if you're the incumbent in your head, you want to limit the number of debates. Mm. Well, he took the complete opposite approach and basically took a carpet bombing approach to debates. I lost count of how many debates there were. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you something. I went to one of them, and I mean, I was ready for it to be done about 20 minutes into it.
Right.
They
were not exciting.
They were not exciting. And
they were intellectually vacuous, too.
Well, debates almost always are. When was there an intellectually stimulating debate ever?
I don't quite, you know, I don't look exactly for intellectual stimulation when I watch political debates. I look for I look for drama,
right,
and interesting ways of expressing ideas. There was almost none of that in these debates. The few moments of levity were provided probably unintentionally by
Willie Wilson.
You know, there's an apocryphal story about the Harold Washington campaign in 1983 when he first ran. The last debate, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was a moment where he proved that he could actually be a smart guy.
That's right.
And that debate, well, he was a smart guy, but, you know, he proved it in a debate. And I think for a lot of people, that was a turning moment. And that's when it changed. All these people suddenly said, oh, he's an alternative. And I don't think that either Fioretti or Garcia actually had that moment.
Tony Arnold, quickly, did you see anybody running against Rahm with stature, gravitas?
Yeah, I think that this is... I don't know if this campaign has gotten as much attention as it did 4 years ago when it was an open seat. But, you know, what I'm going to be looking for really is how the city council is made up. This won't be probably decided on Tuesday, but it'll keep going because the city council ultimately decides, you know, whether any of the mayor's initiatives pass or not. And so, you know, this is something that gets a lot of criticism for going right along with Rahm, mock and step, a lot. And so to see how much resistance actually wins election to the mayor is going to be, I think, just as interesting as to whether
it's already
wins.
Interesting for some viewers because this program is being taped before this February 24th election. So, well, we'll find out what happens eventually. That's all we have time for. I want to thank my guest, Dan Rutherford, former treasurer for the state of Illinois. Thank you to Eric Herman, Managing Director of ASGC, the public affairs and communications firm founded by David Axelrod. Tony Arnold, statewide politics reporter for WBEZ at 91.5 FM and 91.5 FM, right. And in the last Arbitron rating, tied for 10th place in the important, demographically desirable morning drive hours here in Chicago. And as usual, Mike Forche of AlderTrack, the online news source for all things aldermanic in the February 24th election. Remember, you can view this program on Comcast Channel 100, Monday through Saturday. Check the Comcast Channel 100 site for viewing times. And always online at beyondthebeltway.com. Just click on the TV button. Beyond the Beltway is a Jenny B. production with special thanks to Dan Dorfman, Dylan Klauke, and Fritz Goldman for getting this program on the air, especially Dylan. I'm Dan Miller, substituting for the last time for Bruce Dumont, who returns to this seat next week. He'll be back next week, and I hope you'll join him then. For now, goodbye from Chicago.